an interview with Elizabeth Hill Johnson in the Jefferson Room of the Oregon Historical Center. The date is June 26, 1986. The interviewer is Rick Harmon for the Oregon Historical Society. This is tape one, side one. Mrs. Johnson, I'd like to begin this morning by asking you simply to give your complete given name and the place and date of your birth.
I was born in Fort Wayne, Indiana on August the 21st, 1913, and my name given to me at that time was just Elizabeth Hill. Mm-hmm. Later on, when I went to Wellesley College as a graduate student, I discovered that there was already an Elizabeth Hill there. So they said since she'd been there first, that was her name, and our mail would get absolutely confused beyond belief if I didn't have a middle name. And so I simply chose the name Avery because that was my maternal grandmother's name, and it seemed to work well in between Elizabeth and Hill.
I see.
So that's the way I became Elizabeth Avery Hill. Later on, when my mother had to get a birth certificate for me when I was getting ready to join the Navy, she made it official by getting it onto the new birth certificate. My original birth certificate burned when the Allen County Courthouse in Fort Wayne, Indiana burned up.
I see. Okay. Well, let's also record the names of your parents at this point.
My mother's maiden name was Lydia Mary Amelia Buechner, B-U-E-C-H-N-E-R. And my father's name was Harry Walter Hill.
Okay. Now, what were the circumstances of your parents coming together and eventually going to Fort Wayne, where you were born?
Rather strange, they both came from Fort Wayne, and I really don't know that much about their courtship. My father was a railroad baggage master on what was then called the Nickel Plate Railroad. Its official name was the New York, Chicago, and St. Louis. My mother was a buyer and a model at a store called Newcomb Endicott's in Detroit, and I'm sure they must have met some place in Fort Wayne, and they were married in Fort Wayne, actually, on June the 5th, 1912.
And you followed shortly thereafter, then?
I followed shortly thereafter, right, after they had moved to Bellevue, Ohio, because my father worked out of a division point of the Nickel Plate Railroad, and Bellevue was one of those division points. Fort Wayne was another. Most of my relatives on both my mother and my father's side were railroaders.
I see.
Including my paternal grandfather. My uncle was an engineer, and another uncle was a brakeman. And I guess that's all the ones that were railroaders. My grandfather Hill had worked for the railroad until he was in an accident, and one of his legs was amputated below the knee, and so then he was retired.
I see. Okay.
I think he was a conductor.
So then you must have, the family must have moved to Bellevue then, while you were just an infant.
Oh, yes. In fact, I think I was 3 weeks old when I took my first trip on the railroad, and my grandparents, all of them lived in Fort Wayne, so from then on, with railroad passes, we were regular commuters. It was about 125 miles away, mm-hmm. and so we were regulars all our whole lives between Bellevue and Fort Wayne.
I see. Now, did you have any siblings?
I have one brother, who's 2 years and 3 months younger than I am.
I see.
He's a bachelor, and he lives in Bellevue, Ohio still, but he had been in between lots of things. He just went back to our home, the house we grew up in, after my mother died in 1975, and he lives there. So,
what is his name?
His name is Robert Warren Hill.
Okay.
My parents were very short on middle names. They didn't give him a middle name either, and all of the males in the Hillside had a W for an initial. Mother didn't like Walter, So somehow Warren materialized for him.
I see. Okay. And why exactly did the family move from Fort Wayne to Bellevue?
Well, because my father was working out of that Ohio division point.
I see.
Of the railroad. He was always on passenger service. And he went between Bellevue and Chicago.
Okay. Well, can you share with me some of your earliest memories of Bellevue and Fort Wayne? Because, like you said, you continued to go back and forth mm-hmm. between the two cities.
Well, I never was terribly fond of Fort Wayne, to tell you the truth. It's always seemed to me Fort Wayne and Columbus, Ohio were two of the dirtiest, hottest towns that I knew about. I didn't know about that many towns in those days. But Bellevue was an interesting little town in which to grow up, and that's where I grew up and went to public schools till I had gotten out of high school. It was a town that was populated about half by Italians, and the rest mostly people who came from the New England states. So it had very strong New England ties, and at the same time, a lot of Italian immigrants who came to the United States, some from southern Italy, Sicily and the southern tip of Italy, and they worked on the railroad and section gangs and all kinds of restaurants and service sorts of jobs. And then there was a large contingent from the northern part of Italy that worked in the limestone quarries that were thick around that part of Ohio. And limestone, as you know, makes beautiful construction material, and also, of course, lots of crushed stone that they used in all kinds of construction, including laying the railroad beds. About the only thing that those northern Italians and the southern Italians had in common was the Catholic Church. And so there was a very strong contingent of Catholics in the town, and interestingly enough, in those days, and I can remember a few crosses being burned in yards, the Protestant part of the town and the Catholic part of the town did not mingle. Mm-hmm. The Catholics had their own schools, we had the public schools, and yet when we got into high school, it was a good example of cooperation between the publics and the privates, in that the Catholic high school couldn't really afford to have a good chemistry lab and a good physics lab and a band and an orchestra and a debate team, and so the Catholic students came over to the public high school mm-hmm. for those activities, and we saw them, but never dated them. And I guess those of us, at least my class in high school, the girls rather liked that, because there were some very attractive Catholic girls that were kind of off bounds. And in the class in which I graduated, there were 9 fellows and 3 girls who sort of, out of a class of 75, sort of thought we ran things in. And the dating got to be a bit of a problem when 3 or 4 boys would ask you to go to the same dance, but we sort of liked it that way. At any rate, I think my mother was a very strong Lutheran, and she worked very hard for the ecumenical movement when it came along, and she was instrumental in getting a number of Catholic ladies into some of the local clubs that she belonged to, leading off with the Garden Club, which certainly didn't know any boundaries. And she often said that one of the proudest moments in her life was the time when she presided as head of the Lutheran Women's Group, hosting a Mother's Day breakfast, and was able to introduce the Catholic priest to give the invocation and the Lutheran minister to give benediction. And someone else, a Jewish man, I believe it was, spoke in between. One of my very best friends as I grew up was a Jewish girl, and there was never any problem about that. There was one black family in the town, was all. He was a civil engineer. Both his children were outstanding. And one of them was a letter winner at Ohio State, basketball player, and the daughter became a college professor. They were a lovely family. I think we never had any feelings about it, but it I don't know how it happened, but there was just one black family. That's all changed completely now. There are many Spanish people and many blacks live in that town.
You described the town as being basically segregated between the New England white and Protestant community as opposed to the North and South Italian Catholic community. Where did the blacks and the Jews, the few that there were, fit in terms of that arrangement?
The Jewish family, part of them were Methodist. The young people went to the Methodist church because the mother was not Jewish. Mm. Their last name was Wolf, and they had a clothing store, and I believe there were five brothers. And the ones that I knew, of course, best were the ones that had children. And in the family, which I knew best, the father was Jewish, the mother was Norwegian and Lutheran. And so Esther, my friend, went to the Lutheran church, and she and I went to catechism classes and confirmation and all that sort of thing. I do remember the first time that I realized that there was discrimination against them, because I never really thought about it. Mm-hmm. It was just understood. Mr. Wolf went to the Jewish services in Toledo very often. Was at the time that a cousin went to Ohio Wesleyan University, two cousins, Mark and Rachel, I think their names were, and were not admitted to a fraternity or a sorority. Yeah. And Mark then transferred to Cornell. Rachel, I don't remember where she went, but they were both outstanding students. Esther went to Oberlin and later to Ohio State. They were all, of course, very articulate, greatly respected in our town. But I guess I remember very strongly one day when Esther said to me, as we were walking on the boardwalk at Cedar Point, which was a great gathering place for Jewish people from New York wanting to come out. It was right along Lake Erie. Hmm. We lived only 15 miles from Lake Erie, and during the summertime we practically commuted whenever we could afford a car, which was always somebody's parents' car. And she said to me, do I look that Jewish? And that's the first time it ever occurred to me that she might look any different from anybody. It never was a point of discussion. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I don't know why I'm mentioning this, because it wasn't really any great part of my growing up, except that Bellevue was a town mostly of lower middle class people. There was one family in town. The grandfather invented the first riding cultivator, and they owned a manufacturing plant called the Ohio Cultivator Company. And one of their daughters, who had gone to Smith College, married a man from Yale. And they were the parents of three of our contemporaries, a boy and two girls. And they were the only family in town that, there was another family by the name of Wright, who were pretty wealthy. Mm-hmm. And then later on, the man who started the Northern Ohio Telephone Company and all of his people became quite wealthy. And they lived in big houses. And they, the one family, I was engaged to the son in that family, so that's how I knew the inner workings of that family. They had maids in uniform and cooks and chauffeurs and that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And it was always quite a thing to be invited to a party at their house, which we did from time to time. And I remember one young man who was a good friend of ours, and always knew he wanted to be an interior decorator. And he used to regale my mother with stories of how he would redo everything, and he had packing boxes that he would arrange and things that he would cut out of magazines. And he really was at heart a decorator right from the time he was a little shaver. When he was invited to the first birthday party up there, he came back, and I always remember him sitting in my mother's kitchen while she was ironing, and he was explaining every detail of every room in that huge house. And so that was a party to which I was not invited. He was. But at any rate, he later became an interior decorator at the Higbee store in Cleveland.
Aside from these two or three wealthy families, then everybody else, or most everybody else, whether they were of New England stock or Italian stock, was approximately in the lower middle class level.
That's right. Their fathers owned filling stations, or a Baptist minister, or other railroad people. One of the most brilliant fellows in our class who became a medical doctor, his father was the stationary engineer at the laundry. So we all came from a highly working class background. And during the Depression, and actually the railroad people were better off during the Depression than some of the other people, because my father always was paid. They weren't paid very much. My father, I think, was making $80 a month when my mother and father were married. And in 7 years, they had two children and built a house and paid off the mortgage. And my mother raised everything that we ate except the meat. And we had relatives that lived out in the country that did butchering. And so mother tried out the lard and made head cheese and made sausage and pickled and preserved and canned and made ketchup and chili sauce and all of that sort of thing. Did all our own pickles. She was a tremendously able lady who never had a chance for an education. She went through the first 8 grades in a German Lutheran parochial school. And she wasn't permitted to get out of the 8th grade because she wasn't old enough. And so she taught the 8th grade. She was in the public schools just 55 days. And she led her class at the end of those 55 days. But her family was so poor. My grandfather at that time was a policeman. And this was during one of the administrations where there was a bad depression. The name of the president escapes me for the moment. But at any rate, mother had just one dress to wear to school and one dress to wear to church. And her mother had to wash her dress over the weekend so she'd be ready to go to school again. Mm-hmm. And she talked often, I never knew this kind of poverty, of course, at all, about their eating potato soup day after day. But they were a very resourceful German family. And my mother always had great ambitions to do something, and she had the ability, but she was the oldest in a German family responsible for all the other kids, really. Mm-hmm. And at age 14, she left home, and she didn't leave home, she started to work in a bakery, and I think she made something like $1.75 a week, and then later worked her way into the clothing industry, where she did very well. But she was an extremely intelligent person, and I used to say one of the most educated women that I knew. And of course I didn't know that many, but I remember when she was first invited to join one of the literary clubs in town, she said, "Oh, Elizabeth, how could I possibly do that and give papers with women who've graduated from Smith College and Wellesley College and other colleges? I just don't see how I could do it." Well, it never really bothered her that much. She did it very well. And after she died, I knew she was interested in religious philosophy, and she always was the program director of the women of the church, of the Lutheran church, and she was absolutely opposed to listening to somebody read something out of the Lutheran standard, so she always insisted that they have an outside speaker or that they talk about religious philosophy, and there were notes in her Bible quoting from various philosophers, Tillich and Niebold and I don't know who all else, and she was just constantly reading, listening, thinking, challenging. Our house and our dining room table used to be the gathering place for the whole gang of kids, and I can remember, and a little cottage we had on a lake in Indiana where my mother would encourage us to invite our friends up there, and so there'd be 12 or 14 young people that she was feeding 3 meals a day, cooking on a coal oil stove. But we used to sit around the table for hours after meals, everybody discussing life, love, and the pursuit of happiness, and government, and everything. Mother was one of the early members of the League of Women Voters, and she prided herself on never having missed a single election of any kind after women were permitted to vote. So I was brought up in that kind of atmosphere. My father was much more passive than my mother, but terribly encouraging to her and to my brother and to me. And they both said, you're going to go to college someday, you're going to go as far as we can take you. And my father constantly said, what you have in your head, they can never take away from you. And people were losing money all over the place. These were the days when people were jumping out of windows during the Depression. But as I said, my father always was paid. You could buy a lot in those days for little money. And my mother had those wonderful German ways of stretching everything.
Yes. When you described her own childhood and young life, growing up in fairly strained financial circumstances. Now, was that in Fort Wayne?
Yes.
Okay.
She grew up there. And I never knew the family home mm-hmm. where she lived. I knew when my grandmother and grandfather moved to another street. But it was always in a very definitely working man's neighborhood. And my grandmother and grandfather had a house here. And my one uncle and his wife and six children had a house here. And my aunt and her husband and no children had a house here. So when we visited the family in Fort Wayne, they were all in three houses on High Street. and we got to know those six cousins there better than we knew any of my father's family, all of whom lived in Chicago. He had a half-brother whose last name was Gallagher. My grandmother had been married to a Mr. Gallagher who died, and then she married my grandfather, and they had two more sons who were Hills. But they all lived in Chicago, except my father.
I see. Okay. Now, you described your father's occupation as being a railroad baggage master. Did that require him to be away from the household for
yes.
fair amounts of time?
Yes. Mm-hmm. He would leave Bellevue on a train that left about 2 o'clock in the morning, and it went to Chicago. And then he would lay over in Chicago all that day, during which time he slept. But he also visited Chicago stores, and he was intrigued by men who were demonstrating gadgets. And my mother used to say, please, please, no more gadgets. We had apple corers and cherry pitters and you name it, because my dad would be intrigued by watching those people in the stores. Then he would leave Chicago on a night train, and he would get to Bellevue at 6 o'clock in the morning. And he used to walk between our house and down at the railroad station where he caught the train, and walked back. And I remember he always prided himself on never wearing an overcoat, but what people didn't know was that he wore dual fold underwear all the time in the winter time. But he huffed and puffed back and forth, and I often thought of that awful weather lots of times, and the nights that he traveled up and down that railroad and to see that we had what we had. And my mother and father, I know, lots of times got things for us that we really shouldn't have had because of the income that we had, but they did it, and I guess my brother and I took care of the things we got. I think particularly of the first bicycle I ever got, and it was an absolutely deluxe bicycle. And there was a neighbor of ours, Mr. Shug, had a hardware store, and my mother told me to stop by Shug's hardware store, that there was something I should pick up and bring home. So I did, and when I went in, they wheeled out this beautiful bicycle that I'd been looking at.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, oh, thank you very much, but I know that bicycle costs $45, and my father can't afford that. And so I didn't take it home. And here was my mother and father standing on the porch of our house, waiting for me to come sailing around the corner from Northwest Street up Fairfield Avenue on my bicycle. Instead, I'm walking home. So they had quite a job persuading me they really could afford it. We should go back and get it. So I got it. And then when my brother's birthday came along in November, he got one too. And I remember we kept those in the living room of our house for I don't know how long, despite the fact we had a garage, because we polished them every night and sort of spit and polished them, really. And when I was a little girl, and we believed in Santa Claus to a ridiculously old age, but I was only about 9 years old then, and I was a strong believer in Santa Claus. And there was a Mrs. Mallory who had a hat and gift shop on Main Street. You knew everybody in that little town in those days. And you knew everybody who had the grocery store and the shoe store and the meat market and all that sort of thing. And Mrs. Mallory had two dolls. They were beautiful dolls with bisque heads and joints that moved. One had a blonde wig and one had a brunette wig, but outside of that, the dolls were the same, and I can't remember how much they were, but pretty expensive in those days. Probably $28 or $30, something like that, for the doll. And every day after school, before Christmas, in about the 2 months before Christmas, and I'd see those dolls in the window, I would go in and I'd hold one time, and I'd hold one another time, and I couldn't make up my mind which I should ask Santa Claus to bring me, the blonde or the brunette. And what I didn't know was that my dear sweet mother was going down to the store and had already decided on one of them and was making a complete layette for the thing, all handmade baby clothes, long dresses, petticoats, hats, eiderdown blankets, and all of that, because I had a beautiful doll buggy, wicker, that turned around and she made a corduroy top over it, you know, so that you used to put the baby under the thing with a corduroy back on it, had little windows on the side. And when I came down for Christmas, there was that beautiful blonde doll. But just right before that, I had come home crying because I said, oh, Mother, the blonde doll was the one I really wanted, and Mrs. Mallory told me it had been sold and the lady had taken it home. And it was my dear mother taking it home because she just couldn't keep walking all the way downtown, which, oh, probably was 6 or 7 blocks. Uh-huh. All the time in that inclement weather. Nobody had a lot of protection against the snow, and we had lots of it in northern Ohio, and ice. I remember belly flopping on sleds behind, the wagons that the farmers would use in the wintertime had runners on them, and hitching rides on those kinds of wagons that were sleds, really, and later on cars. And we didn't have any hills much in Ohio. There were a couple of them, I mean, in that part of Ohio, a couple of them that we used to slide down on our sleds. But winters were cold and summers were hot and humid.
Mm-hmm. Well, you described your father as being passive but very encouraging of your interests and your mother's interests. His passivity was toward education and knowledge.
My father was not intellectual, or he didn't read as much as my mother did, or anything. I think railroaders were inclined to be great readers of newspapers and magazines, and they were great sidewalk philosophers, but not very intellectual. No, my mother and father each just went through the eighth grade, but my father dropped out of school because he wanted to. Mm-hmm. My mother did because they couldn't afford it. And I think my father was always kind of in awe of my mother. She was clearly, I think, intellectually the leader in the family, and he always said, when we would ask something, ask your mother. Mm. What does your mother say? Mm-hmm. And he deferred to her because he wanted to. And mother took the leadership position because she always had. Mm-hmm. She was the leader in her family, she and her father, and then her father was killed very suddenly in an accident when mother was probably in her late 30s. And from then on, she was the leader completely of that whole family. Mm-hmm. And She just was a born leader, that's all. No matter where she would be, she sort of gravitated into it. And I think it was a role she enjoyed, but at the same time, I think she would have liked sometimes not to have to take the responsibility for a lot of things that she did. Sure. When my